Yes, he's done well, twisting science the way he has.
You don't approve?
Restructuring DNA in plants and animals? No. Nature has evolved without our assistance for 2 billion years at least. I doubt that it needs help from us.
There are some things man is not meant to know, the senator asked with a chuckle.
His professional background was in contracting, in gouging holes in the ground and erecting something that nature didn't want there. Though his sensitivity on environmental issues, Dr. Breitling thought, had itself evolved from his love of Washington and his desire to remain here in a position of power. It was called Potomac fever, a disease easily caught and less easily cured.
The problem, Senator Hawking, is that nature is both complex and subtle. When we change things, we cannot easily predict the ramifications of the changes. It's called the law of unintended consequences, something with which the Congress is familiar, isn't it?
You mean?
I mean that the reason we have a federal law about environmental impact statements is that it's far easier to mess things up than it is to get them right. In the case of recombinant DNA, we can more easily change the genetic code than we can evaluate the effects those changes will cause a century from now. That sort of power is one that should be used with the greatest possible care. Not everyone seems to grasp that simple fact.
Which point was difficult to argue with, the senator had to concede gracefully. Breitling would be making that case before his committee in another week. Had that been the thing that had broken up the marriage of John and Carol Breitling? How very sad. With that observation, the senator made his excuses and headed off to join his wife.
There's nothing new in that point of view.
John Breitling's doctorate in molecular biology came from the University of Virginia, along with his M.D. It started with a guy named Ned Ludd a few centuries ago. He was afraid that the Industrial Revolution would put an end to the cottage industry economy in England. And he was right. That economic model was wrecked. But what replaced it was better for the consumer. And that's why we call it progress. Not surprisingly, John Breitling, a billionaire heading for number two, was holding court before a small crowd of admirers.
But the complexity, one of the audience started to object.
Happens every day, every second, in fact. And so do the things we're trying to conquer. Cancer, for example. No, madam, are you willing to put an end to our work if it means no cure for breast cancer? That disease strikes 5% of the human population worldwide. Cancer is a genetic disease. The key to curing it is in the human genome. And my company is going to find that key.
Aging is the same thing.
Salk's team at La Jolla found the Kill Me gene more than 15 years ago. If we can find a way to turn it off, then human immortality can be real. Madam, does the idea of living forever in a body of 25 years' maturity appeal to you?
But what about overcrowding?
The Congresswoman's objection was somewhat quieter than her first. It was too vast a thought, too surprisingly posed, to allow an immediate objection.
One thing at a time. The invention of DDT killed off huge quantities of disease-bearing insects. And that increased populations all over the world, didn't it?
Okay, we are a little more crowded now, but who wants to bring the Anopheles mosquito back? Is malaria a reasonable method of population control? Nobody here wants to bring war back, right? We used to use that, too, to control populations.
We got over it, didn't we?
Hell, controlling populations is no big deal. It's called birth control. And the advanced countries have already learned how to do it. And the backward countries can, too, if they have a good reason for doing so.
It might take a generation or so, John Breitling mused.
But is there anyone here who would not want to be 25 again? with all the things we've learned along the way, of course. It damned well appeals to me," he went on with a warm smile. With sky-high salaries and promises of stock options, his company had assembled an incredible team of talent to look at that particular gene. The profits that would accrue from its control could hardly be estimated, and the U.S. patent was good for 17 years. Human immortality, the new holy grail for the medical community. And for the first time it was something for serious investigation, not a topic of pulp science fiction stories.
"You think you can do it?" another congresswoman, this one from San Francisco, asked.
Women of all sorts found themselves drawn to this man. Money, power, good looks, and good manners made it inevitable. John Breitling smiled broadly. "Ask me in 5 years. We know the gene. We need to learn how to turn it off. There's a whole lot of basic science in there we have to uncover, and along the way we hope to discover a lot of very useful things. It's like setting off with Magellan. We aren't sure what we're going to find, but we know it'll all be interesting." No one pointed out that Magellan hadn't made it home from that particular trip.
"And profitable?" a new senator from Wyoming asked.
"That's how our society works, isn't it? We pay people for doing useful work. Is this area useful enough?"
"If you bring it off, I suppose it is."
This senator was himself a physician, a family practitioner who knew the basics but was well over his head on the deep scientific side. The concept, the objective of Horizon Corporation, was well beyond breathtaking. But he would not bet against them. They'd done too well developing cancer drugs and synthetic antibiotics, and were the leading private company in the Human Genome Project, a global effort to decode the basics of human life. Himself a genius, John Breitling had found it easy to attract others like himself to his company. He had more charisma than 100 politicians, and, unlike the latter, the senator had to admit to himself he really had something to back up the showmanship. It had once been called the right stuff for pilots. With his movie star looks, ready smile, superb listening ability, and dazzlingly analytical mind, Dr. John Breitling had the knack. He could make anyone near him feel interesting. And the bastard could teach, could apply his lessons to everyone nearby. Simple ones for the unschooled, and highly sophisticated ones for the specialists in his field, at the top of which he reigned supreme. Oh, he had a few peers. Pat Riley at Harvard Mass General, Aaron Bernstein at Johns Hopkins, Jacques Elizet at Pasteur, maybe Paul Ging at UC Berkeley. But that was it. What a fine clinician Breitling might have made, the senator M.D. thought. But no, he was too good to be wasted on people with the latest version of the flu. About the only thing in which he'd failed was his marriage. Well, Carol Breitling was also pretty smart, but more political than scientific, and perhaps her ego, capacious as everyone in the city knew it to be, had quailed before the greater intellectual gifts of her husband. Only room in town for one of us, the doctor from Wyoming thought, with an inner smile. That happened often enough in real life, not just in old movies. And Breitling John seemed to be doing better in that respect than Breitling Carol. At the former's elbow was a very pretty redhead drinking in his every word, while the latter had come alone, and would be leaving alone for her apartment in Georgetown. Well, the senator M.D. thought, that's life. Immortality. Damn, all the pronghorns he might take, the doctor from Cody thought on, heading over to his wife. Dinner was about to start. The chicken had finished the vulcanization process.
The Valium helped.
It wasn't actually Valium, Kilgore knew. That drug had become something of a generic name for mild sedatives, and this one had been developed by Smith Kline, with a different trade name, with the added benefit that it made a good mix with alcohol. For street people who were often as contentious and territorial as junkyard dogs, this group of 10 was remarkably sedate. The large quantities of good booze helped. The high-end bourbons seemed the most popular libations, drunk from cheap glasses with ice, along with various mixers for those who didn't care to drink it neat. Most didn't, to Kilgore's surprise. The physicals had gone well. They were all healthy, sick people, outwardly fairly vigorous, but inwardly all the physical problems ranging from diabetes to liver failure. One was definitely suffering from prostate cancer. His PSA was off the top of the chart. But that wouldn't matter in this particular test, would it? Another was HIV positive, and not yet symptomatic. And so that didn't matter either. He'd probably gotten it from drug use, but strangely, liquor seemed all he needed to keep himself regulated here. How interesting. Kilgore didn't have to be here, and it troubled his conscience to look at them so much. But they were his lab rats, and he was supposed to keep an eye on them, and so he did, behind the mirror, while he did his paperwork and listened to Bach on his portable CD player. Three were, claimed to be, Vietnam veterans. So they'd killed their share of Asians. Gooks was the word they'd used in the interview, before coming apart and ending up as street drunks. Well, homeless people was the current term society used for them, somewhat more dignified than bums, the term Kilgore vaguely remembered his mother using. Not the best example of humanity he'd ever seen. Yet the project had managed to change them quite a bit. All bathed regularly now, and dressed in clean clothes, and watched TV. Some even read books from time to time. Kilgore had thought that providing a library, while cheap, was an outrageously foolish waste of time and money. But always they drank, and the drinking relegated each of the 10 to perhaps 6 hours of full consciousness per day. And the Valium calmed them further, limiting any altercations that his security staff would have to break up. Two of them were always on duty in the next room over, also watching the group of 10. Microphones buried in the ceiling allowed them to listen in to the disjointed conversations. One of the group was something of an authority on baseball, and talked about Mantle and Maris all the time to whoever would listen. Enough of them talked about sex that Kilgore wondered if he should send the snatch team back out to get some female homeless subjects for the experiment. He would tell Barb Archer that. After all, they needed to know if gender had an effect on the experiment. She'd have to buy into that one, wouldn't she? And there'd be none of the sisterly solidarity with them. There couldn't be, even from the feminazi who joined him in running this experiment. Her ideology was too pure for that. Kilgore turned when there came a knock at the door. "Hey, Doc." It was Benny, one of the security guys. "Hey, how's it going?" "Falling asleep," Benjamin Farmer replied. "The kids are playing pretty nice." "Yeah, they sure are." It was so easy. Most had to be prodded a little to leave the room and go out to the courtyard for an hour of walking around every afternoon. But they had to be kept fit, which was to say to simulate the amount of exercise they got on a normal day in Manhattan, staggering from one dreary corner to another. "Damn, Doc, I never knew anybody could put it away the way these guys do. I mean, I had to bring in a whole case of Granddad today, and there's only 2 bottles left." "That their favorite?" Kilgore asked. He hadn't paid much attention to that.
"Seems to be, sir.
I'm a Jack Daniels man myself, but with me maybe two a night, say for Monday night football if it's a good game. I don't drink water the way the kids drink hard booze.
A chuckle from the ex-Marine who ran the night security shift.
A good man, Farmer. He did a lot of things with injured animals at the company's rural shelter. He was also the one who'd taken to calling the test subjects the kids. It had caught on with the security staff, and from them to the others.
Kilgore chuckled.
You had to call them something, and lab rats just wasn't respectful enough. After all, they were human beings, after a fashion, all the more valuable for their place in this test. He turned to see one of them, number 6, pour himself another drink, wander back to his bed, and lie down to watch some TV before he passed out. He wondered what the poor bastard would dream about. Some did, and talked loudly in their sleep. Something to interest a psychiatrist, perhaps, or someone doing sleep studies. They all snored, to the point that when all were asleep it sounded like an old steam-powered railroad yard in there.
Choo-choo, Kilgore thought, looking back down at his last bit of paperwork.
10 more minutes, and he could head home. Too late to put his kids to bed. Too bad. Well, in due course, they would awaken to a new day and a new world, and wouldn't that be some present to give them, however heavy and nasty the price for it might be?
The physician thought. I could use a drink myself.
The future has never been so bright as this, John Breitling told his audience, his demeanor even more charismatic after 2 glasses of a select California Chardonnay. The biosciences are pushing back frontiers we didn't even know existed 15 years ago. 100 years of basic research are coming to bloom even as we speak. We're building on the work of Pasteur, Ehrlich, Salk, Sabin, and so many others. We see so far today because we stand on the shoulders of giants. Well, John Breitling went on, it's been a long climb, but the top of the mountain is in sight, and we will get there in the next few years.
He's smooth, Liz Murray observed to her husband.
Very, FBI Director Dan Murray whispered back. Smart, too. Jimmy Hicks says he's the top guy in the world.
What's he running for?
God, from what he said earlier.
Needs to grow a beard, then.
Director Murray nearly choked at that. Then he was saved by the vibrating of his cellular phone. He discreetly left his seat to walk into the building's large marble foyer. On flipping his phone open, it took 15 seconds for the encryption system to synchronize with the base station calling him, which told him that it was FBI headquarters.
Murray.
Director, this is Gordon Sinclair in the watch center. So far the Swiss have struck out on IDing the other 2. Prints are on their way to the BKA so they can take a look.
But if they hadn't been printed somewhere along the line, that too would be a dry hole. And it would take a while to identify Modell's 2 pals.
No additional casualties on the takedown?
No, sir. All 4 bad guys down for the count. All hostages safe and evacuated. They should all be back home now. Oh, Tim Noonan deployed on this operation. Electronics weenie for one of the go teams.
So Rainbow works, eh?
It did this time, Director, Sinclair judged.
Make sure they send us the write-up on how the operation went down.
Yes, sir. I already emailed them about that.
Less than 30 people in the Bureau knew about Rainbow, though quite a few would be making guesses. Especially those HRT members who'd taken note of the fact that Tim Noonan, a 3rd-generation agent, had dropped off the face of the earth.
How's dinner going?
I prefer Wendy's, more of the basic food groups.
Anything else?
The OC case in New Orleans is close to going down, Billy Betts says. 3 or 4 more days. Aside from that, nothing important happening. Thanks, Gordy. Murray thumbed the end button on his phone and pocketed it, then returned to the dining room after a look and a wave at two members of his protective detail. 30 seconds later, he slid back into his seat, with a muted thump from his holstered Smith & Wesson automatic against the wood. "Anything important?" Liz asked. A shake of the head. Routine. The affair broke up less than 40 minutes after Breitling finished his speech and collected his award plaque. He held court yet again, albeit with a smaller group of fans this time, while drifting toward the door, outside of which waited his car. It was only 5 minutes to the Hay Adams Hotel, across Lafayette Park from the White House. He had a corner suite on the top floor, and the hotel staff had thoughtfully left him a bottle of the house white in an ice bucket next to the bed, for his companion had come along. It was sad, Dr. John Breitling thought, removing the cork. He'd miss things like this, really miss them. But he had made the decision long before, not knowing when he'd started off that it could possibly work. Now he thought that it would, and the things he'd miss were ultimately of far less value than the things he'd get. And for the moment, he thought, looking at Jessica's pale skin and stunning figure, he'd get something else that was pretty nice. It was different for Dr. Carol Breitling. Despite her White House job, she drove her own car without even a bodyguard to her apartment off Wisconsin Avenue in Georgetown, her only companion there a calico cat named Jiggs, who at least came to the door to meet her, rubbing his body along her pantyhosed leg the moment the door was closed, and purring to show his pleasure at her arrival. He followed her into the bedroom, watching her change in the way of cats, interested and detached at the same time, and knowing what came next. Dressed only in a short robe, Carol Breitling walked into the kitchen, opened a cupboard, and got a treat, which she bent down to feed to Jiggs from her hand. Then she got herself a glass of ice water from the refrigerator door, and drank it down with 2 aspirin. It had all been her idea. She knew that all too well. But after so many years, it was still as hard as it had been at first. She'd given up so much more. She'd gotten the job she'd craved, somewhat to her surprise, as things had turned out. But she had the office in the right building, and now played a role in making policy on the issues that were important to her. Important policy on important topics. But was it worth it? Yes. She had to think that, and truly she believed it. But the price of it, was often so hard to bear. She bent down to lift up Jiggs, cradling him like the child she'd never had, and walking to the bedroom, where, again, he'd be the only one to share it with her. Well, a cat was far more faithful than a man could ever be. She'd learned that lesson over the years. In a few seconds, the robe was on the chair next to the bed, she under the covers, with Jiggs atop them and between her legs. She hoped sleep would come a little more quickly tonight than it usually did. But she knew it would not, for her mind would not stop thinking about what was happening in another bed less than 3 miles away. Chapter 5. Ramifications. Daily PT started at 06:30 and concluded with the 5-mile run, timed to last exactly 40 minutes. This morning it ended at 38, and Chavez wondered if he and his team had an additional spring in their step from the successful mission. If so, was that good or bad? Killing fellow human beings wasn't supposed to make you feel good, was it? A deep thought for a foggy English morning. By the end of the run, everyone had a good sweat, which the hot showers took care of. Oddly, hygiene was a little more complicated for his team than for uniformed soldiers. Nearly everyone had longer hair than their respective armies permitted, so that they could look like grown-up, if somewhat shabby, businessmen when they donned their coats and ties for their first-class flights to wherever. Ding's hair was the shortest, since at CIA he'd tried to keep it not too different from his time as staff sergeant in the ninjas. It would have to grow for at least another month before it would be shaggy enough. He grunted at that thought, then stepped out of the shower. As Team 2 leader, he rated his own private facility, and he took the time to admire his body, always an object of pride for Domingo Chavez. Yeah, the exercise that had been so tough the first week had paid off. He hadn't been much tougher than this in Ranger School at Fort Benning. And he'd been, what, 21 then? Just an E-4, and one of the smallest men in the class. It was something of an annoyance to Ding that, tall and rangy like her mom, Patsy had half an inch on him. But Patsy only wore flats, which kept it respectable, and nobody messed with him. Like his boss, he had the look of a man with whom one did not trifle. Especially this morning, he thought, while toweling off. He'd zapped a guy the previous night, just as fast and automatic an action as zipping his zipper. Tough shit, Herr Gutenach. Back home, Patsy was already dressed in her greens. She was on an OBGYN rotation at the moment, scheduled to perform, well, to assist on, a cesarean section this morning at the local hospital, where she was completing what in America would have been her year of internship. Next would be her pediatric rotation, which struck both of them as totally appropriate. Already on the table for him was bacon and eggs. The eggs in England seemed to have brighter yolks. He wondered if they fed their chickens differently here. "I wish you'd eat better," Patsy observed again. Domingo laughed, reaching for his morning paper, the Daily Telegraph. "Honey, my cholesterol is 130, my resting heart rate is 56. I am a lean, mean, fighting machine, doctor." "But what about 10 years from now?" Patricia Chavez, M.D., asked. "I'll have 10 complete physicals between now and then, and I will adjust my lifestyle according to how those work out," Domingo Chavez, Master of Science, International Relations, answered, buttering his toast. The bread in this country, he'd learned over the past 6 weeks, was just fabulous. Why did people knock English food? "Hell, Patsy, look at your dad. That old bastard is still in great shape." Though he hadn't run this morning, and at his best was hard-pressed to finish the 5 miles at the pace Team 2 set. Well, he was well over 50. His shooting, however, hadn't suffered very much at all. John had worked to make that clear to the go-team members. One of the best pistoleros Chavez had ever seen, and better still with a sniper rifle. He was dead level with Weber and Johnston, out to 400 meters. Despite the suit he wore to work, Rainbow Six was on everyone's don't-fuck-with list. The front page had a story on the previous day's events in Bern. Ding raced through it and found most of the details right. Remarkable. The Telegraph's correspondent must have had good contacts with the cops, whom he gave credit for the takedown. Well, that was okay. Rainbow was supposed to remain black. No comment from the Ministry of Defense on whether the SAS had provided support to the Swiss police. That was a little weak. A flat no would have been better. But, were that to be said, then a no comment, spoken at some other time, would be taken as a yes. So, yeah, that probably made sense. Politics was not a skill he'd acquired yet, at least not on the instinctive level. Dealing with the media frightened him more than facing loaded weapons. He had training for the latter, but not for the former. His next grimace came when he realized that while CIA had an Office of Public Affairs, Rainbow sure as hell didn't. Well, in this business it probably didn't pay to advertise. About that time, Patsy put on her jacket and headed for the door. Ding hurried after her to deliver the goodbye kiss, watched his wife walk to the family car, and hoped she did better driving on the left side of the road than he did. It made him slightly nuts and required steady concentration. The really crazy part was that the gear shift was in the middle, the wrong side of the car, but the pedals were the same as in American autos. It made Chavez a little schizophrenic, driving left-handed and right-footed. The worst part was the traffic circles the Brits seemed to like better than real interchanges. Ding kept wanting to turn right instead of left. It would be a hell of a stupid way to get killed. 10 minutes later, dressed in his day uniform, Chavez walked over to the Team 2 building for the second AAR. Popoff tucked his passbook in his coat pocket. The Swiss banker hadn't even blinked at seeing the suitcase full of cash. A remarkable machine had counted the bills, like mechanical fingers riffling through a deck of playing cards, even checking the denominations as it did the counting. It had taken a total of 45 minutes to get things fully arranged. The number on the account was his old KGB service number, and, tucked in the passbook, was the banker's business card, complete with his internet address for making wire transfers. The proper code phrase had been agreed upon and written into his bank file. The topic of Model's failed adventure of the previous day hadn't come up. Popoff figured he'd read the press reports in the International Herald Tribune, which he'd get at the airport. His passport was American. The company had arranged to get him resident alien status, and he was on his way to citizenship, which he found amusing, as he still had his Russian Federation passport and two others from his previous career, with different names but the same photo, which he could still use if needed. Those were stashed in his travel briefcase, in a small compartment that only a very careful customs examiner would ever find, and then only if told ahead of time that there was something strange about the incoming traveler. 2 hours before his flight was scheduled to depart, he turned in his rental car, rode the bus to the international terminal, went through the usual rigmarole of checking in, and headed off to the first-class lounge for coffee and a croissant. Bill Henriksen was a news junkie of the first order. On waking up, early as always, he immediately flipped his TV to CNN, often flipping to Fox News with his remote while he did his morning treadmill routine, frequently with a paper on the reading board as well. The front page on the New York Times covered the event in Bern, as did Fox News. Oddly, CNN talked about it, but didn't show much. Fox did, using the feed from Swiss television, which allowed him to watch what could be seen of the takedown. Pure vanilla, Henriksen thought. Flashbangs on the front doors. Made the cameraman jump and go slightly off target, as usual when they were that close. Shooters in right behind them. No sounds of gunfire. They used suppressed weapons. In 5 seconds it was all over. So the Swiss had a properly trained SWAT team. No real surprise there, though he hadn't really known about it. A few minutes later, one guy came out and lit a pipe. Whoever that was, probably the team commander, he had a little style, Henriksen thought, checking the mileage on the treadmill. The team dressed, as such people usually did, in coal-gray fatigues, with Kevlar body armor. Uniformed cops went in to get the hostages out after about the right amount of time. Yeah, nicely and smoothly done. Another way of saying that the criminals, slash terrorists, the news wasn't clear on whether they were just robbers or political types, weren't real smart. Well, whoever said they were. They'd have to choose better ones the next time if this thing were going to work. The phone would ring in a few minutes, he was sure, summoning him to do a brief TV spot. A nuisance, but a necessary one. That happened when he was in the shower. He'd long since had a phone installed just outside the door.
"Yeah?" "Mr. Henriksen?"
"Yeah, who's this?"
The voice wasn't familiar.
"Bob Smith at Fox News, New York. Have you seen the coverage of the incident in Switzerland?"
"Yeah, matter of fact, I just saw it on your network."
"Any chance you could come in and give us some commentary?"
"What time?" Henriksen asked, knowing the response and what his answer would be.
"Just after 8, if you could."
He even checked his watch, an automatic and wasted gesture that nobody saw.
"Yeah, I can do that.
How long will I be on this time?"
"Probably 4 minutes or so."
"Okay, I'll be down there in about an hour."
"Thank you, sir. The guard will be told to expect you."
"Okay, see you in an hour."
The kid must be new, Henriksen thought, not to know that he was a regular commentator. Why else would his name have been in the Fox Rolodex? And that the security guards all knew him by sight. A quick cup of coffee and a bagel got him out the door, into his Porsche 911, and across the George Washington Bridge to Manhattan.
Dr. Carol Breitling awoke, patted Jiggs on the top of his head, and stepped into the shower. 10 minutes later, a towel wrapped around her head, she opened the door and got the morning papers. The coffee machine had already made its 2 cups of mountain-grown Folgers, and in the refrigerator was the plastic box full of melon sections. Next, she switched on the radio to catch the morning edition of All Things Considered, beginning her news fix, which started here and would go on through most of the day. Her job in the White House was mainly reading. And today, she had to meet with that bozo from the Department of Energy, who still thought it important to build H-bombs, which she would advise the president against, which advice he would probably decline without direct comment to her. Why the hell had she been taken in by this administration, Carol wondered. The answer was simple and obvious. Politics. This president had tried valiantly to avoid such entanglements in his year and a half of holding office. And she was female, whereas the president's team of insiders was almost entirely male, which had caused some comment in the media and elsewhere, which had befuddled the president in his political innocence, which had amused the press even more, and given them a further tool to use, which had worked, after a fashion. And so she had been offered the appointment, and taken it, with the office in the old executive office building instead of the White House itself, with a secretary and an assistant, and a parking place on West Executive Drive for her fuel-efficient 6-year-old Honda, the only Japanese-made car on that particular block, which nobody had said anything about, of course, since she was female. And she'd forgotten more about Washington politics than the president would ever learn. That was astounding, when she thought about it, though she warned herself that the president was a notoriously quick learner, but not a good listener, at least as far as she was concerned. The media let him get away with it. The lesson of that was that the media was nobody's friend. Lacking convictions of its own, it just published what people said. And so she had to speak, off the record, on deep background, or just casually to various reporters. Some, those who covered the environment regularly, at least understood the language, and for the most part could be trusted to write their pieces the proper way. But they always included the other side's rubbish science. "Yes, maybe your position has merit, but the science isn't firm enough yet, and the computer models are not accurate enough to justify this sort of action," the other side said. As a result of which the public's opinion, as measured in polls, had stagnated, or even reversed a little bit.
The president was anything but an environmental president, but the bastard was getting away with it, at the same time using Carol Breitling as political camouflage, or even political cover. That appalled her, or would have under other circumstances. But here she was, Dr. Breitling thought, zipping up her skirt before donning the suit jacket, a senior advisor to the President of the United States. That meant she saw him a couple of times per week. It meant that he read her position papers and policy recommendations. It meant that she had access to the media's top-drawer people, free to pursue her own agenda, within reason. But she was the one who paid the price. Always it was she, Carol thought, reaching down to scratch Jiggs's ears as she made her way to the door. The cat would pass the day doing whatever it was that he did, mainly sleeping in the sun on the windowsill, probably waiting for his mistress to come home and feed him his frisky treat. Not for the first time she thought about stopping by a pet store and getting Jiggs a live mouse to play with and eat. A fascinating process to watch, predator and prey, playing their parts. The way the world was supposed to be, the way it had been for unnumbered centuries until the last two or so. Until man had started changing everything, she thought, starting the car, looking at the cobblestoned street. Still real cobbles for this traditional Georgetown address, with streetcar tracks still there, too, and brick buildings which had covered up what had probably been a pretty hardwood forest less than 200 years before. It was even worse across the river, where only Theodore Roosevelt Island was still in its pristine state, and that was interfered with by the screech of jet engines. A minute later, she was on M Street, then around the circle onto Pennsylvania Avenue. She was ahead of the daily rush-hour traffic, as usual, heading the mile or so down the wide, straight street before she could turn right and find her parking place. They weren't reserved, per se, but everyone had his or her own, and hers was 40 yards from the west entrance. And, as a regular, she didn't have to submit to the dog search. The Secret Service used Belgian Malinois dogs, like brown German shepherds, keen of nose and quick of brain, to sniff at cars for explosives. Her White House pass got her into the compound, then up the steps into the OEOB, and right to her office. It was a cubbyhole, really, but larger than those of her secretary and assistant. On her desk was the Early Bird, with its clips of articles from various national newspapers deemed important to those who worked in this building, along with her copy of Science Weekly, Science, and Today, Scientific American, plus several medical journals. The environmental publications would arrive 2 days later. She hadn't yet sat down when her secretary, Margot Evans, came in with the code word folder on nuclear weapons policy, which she'd have to review before giving the president advice that he'd reject. The annoying part of that, of course, was that she'd have to think to produce the position paper that the president would not think about before rejecting. But she couldn't give him an excuse to accept, with great public reluctance, her resignation. Rarely did anyone at this level ask to leave, per se, though the local media had the mantras down and fully understood. Why not take it a step further than usual and recommend the closure of the dirty reactor at Hanford, Washington? The only American reactor of the same design as Chernobyl, less a power reactor than one designed to produce plutonium, PU-239, for nuclear weapons, the worst gadget the mind of warlike men had ever produced. There were new problems with Hanford, new leaks from the storage tanks there, discovered before the leakage could pollute groundwater, but still a threat to the environment, expensive to fix. The chemical mix in those tanks was horribly corrosive, and lethally toxic, and radioactive. and the president wouldn't listen to that bit of sound advice either. The science of her objections to Hanford was real. Even Red Lowell worried about it. But he wanted a new Hanford built. Even this president wouldn't countenance that. With that reassuring thought, Dr. Breitling poured herself a cup of coffee and started reading The Early Bird, while her mind pondered how she'd draft her doomed recommendation to the president.
"So, Mr. Henriksen, who were they?" the morning anchor asked.
"We don't know much beyond the name of the purported leader, Ernst Model. Model was once part of the Bader-Meinhof gang, the notorious German communist terrorist group from the 70s and 80s. He dropped out of sight about 10 years ago. It will be interesting to learn exactly where he's been hiding out."
"Did you have a file on him during your time with the FBI hostage rescue team?"
A smile to accompany the terse reply.
"Oh, yeah. I know the face, but Mr. Model will now transfer to the inactive files."
"So, was this a terrorist incident or just a bank robbery?"
"No telling as yet from press reports, but I would not entirely discount robbery as a motive. One of the things people forget about terrorists is that they have to eat, too. And you need money to do that. There is ample precedent for supposedly political criminals to break the law just to make money to support themselves. Right here in America, the CSA, the Covenant, the Sword and the Arm of the Lord, as they call themselves, robbed banks to support themselves. Bader-Meinhof in Germany used kidnappings to extort money from their victims' corporate and family ties.
So, to you, they're just criminals?"
A nod and a serious expression.
"Terrorism is a crime. That's dogma at the FBI, where I came up. And these four who got killed yesterday in Switzerland were criminals. Unfortunately for them, the Swiss police have assembled and trained what appears to be an excellent professional special operations team."
"How would you rate the takedown?"
"Pretty good. The TV coverage shows no errors at all. All the hostages were rescued, and the criminals all were killed. That's par for the course in an incident like this. In the abstract, you would like to take the criminals down alive if possible, but it is not always possible. The lives of the hostages have absolute priority in a case like this one."
"But the terrorists, don't they have rights?"
"As a matter of principle, yes, they do have the same rights as other criminals. We teach that at the FBI, too, and the best thing you can do as a law enforcement officer in a case like this one is to arrest them, put them in front of a judge and jury, and convict them. But remember that the hostages are innocent victims, and their lives are at risk because of the criminals' actions. Therefore, you try to give them a chance to surrender. Really, you try to disarm them if you can. But very often you do not have that luxury," Henriksen went on. "Based on what I saw on TV from this incident, the Swiss police team acted no differently than what we were trained to do at Quantico. You only use deadly force when necessary. But when it's necessary, you do use it."
"But who decides when it's necessary?"
"The commander on the scene makes that decision, based on his training, experience, and expertise."
"Then," Henriksen didn't go on, "people like you second-guess the hell out of him for the next couple of weeks."
"Your company trains local police forces in SWAT tactics, doesn't it?"
"Yes, it does. We have numerous veterans of the FBI HRT, Delta Force, and other special organizations, and we could use this Swiss operation as a textbook example of how it's done," Henriksen said. "Because his was an international corporation, which trained foreign police forces as well, and being nice to the Swiss wouldn't hurt his bottom line one bit."
"Well, Mr. Henriksen, thanks for joining us this morning. International terrorism expert William Henriksen, CEO of Global Security, Inc., an international consulting firm. It's 24 minutes after the hour." In the studio, Henriksen kept his calm, professional face on until 5 seconds after the light on the nearest camera went out. At his corporate headquarters, they would have already taped this interview to add to the vast library of such things. GSI was known over most of the world, and their introductory tape included snippets from many such interviews. The floor director walked him off the set to the makeup room, where the powder was removed, then let him walk himself out to where his car was parked. That had gone well, he thought, going through the mental checklist. He'd have to find out who'd trained the Swiss. He made a mental note to have one of his contacts chase that one down. If it were a private company, that was serious competition, though it was probably the Swiss Army, perhaps even a military formation disguised as policemen. Maybe with some technical assistance from the German GSG-9. A couple of phone calls should run that one down. Popov's four-engine Airbus A340 touched down on time at JFK International. You could always trust the Swiss to do everything on time. The police team had probably even had a schedule for the previous night's activities, he thought whimsically. His first-class seat was close to the door, which allowed him to be the third passenger out, then off to claim his bags and go through the ordeal of U.S. Customs. America, he'd long since learned, was the most difficult country to enter as a foreigner, though with his minimal baggage and nothing to declare entry, the process was somewhat easier this time. The customs clerks were kind and waved him right through to the cab stand, where, for the usual exorbitant fee, he engaged a Pakistani driver to take him into town, making him wonder idly if the cabbies had a deal with the customs people. But he was on an expense account, meaning he had to get a receipt, and, besides, he had insured that day that he could afford such things without one, hadn't he? He smiled as he gazed at the passing urban sprawl. It got thicker and thicker on the way to Manhattan. The cab dropped him off at his apartment house. The flat was paid for by his employer, which made it a tax-deductible business expense for them. Popov was learning about American tax law, and free for him. He spent a few minutes dumping his dirty laundry and hanging up his good clothes before heading downstairs and having the doorman flag a cab. From there it was another 15 minutes to the office. "So, how did it go?" the boss asked. There was an odd buzz in the office, designed to interfere with any listening devices that a corporate rival might place. Corporate espionage was a major factor in the life of this man's company, and the defenses against it were at least as good as those the KGB had used. And Popov had once believed that governments had the best of everything. That was certainly not true in America.
"It went much as I expected. They were foolish, really rather amateurish, despite all the training we gave them back in the 80s. I told them to feel free to rob the bank as cover for the real mission."
"Which was?"
"To be killed," Dmitri Arkadyevich replied at once. "At least, that is what I understood your intentions to be, sir."
His words occasioned a smile of a sort Popov wasn't used to. He made a note to check the stock value of the bank. Had the intention of this mission been to affect the standing of the bank? That didn't seem very likely, but though he didn't need to know why he was doing these things, his natural curiosity had been aroused. This man was treating him like a mercenary, and though Popov knew that was precisely what he'd become since leaving the service of his country, it was vaguely and distantly annoying to his sense of professionalism.
"Will you require further such services?"
"What happened to the money?" the boss wanted to know. A diffident reply.
"I'm sure the Swiss will find a use for it."
"Certainly his banker would."
"Surely you did not expect me to recover it?"
a shake of the boss's head. No, not really, and it was a trivial sum anyway. Popoff nodded his understanding.
Trivial sum?
No Soviet-employed agent had ever gotten so much in a single payment. The KGB had always been niggardly in its payments to those whom it gave money, regardless of the importance of the information that had earned it. Nor had the KGB ever been so casual in disposing of cash in any amount. Every single ruble had to be accounted for, else the bean counters at No. 2 Dzerzhinsky Square would bring down the devil's own wrath on the field officer who'd been so lax in his operations. The next thing he wondered about was how his employer had laundered the cash. In America, if you deposited or withdrew so little as $10,000 in cash, the bank was required to make a written record of it. It was supposedly an inconvenience for the drug dealers, but they managed to work with it nevertheless. Did other countries have similar rules? Popoff didn't know. Switzerland did not, he was sure. But that many banknotes didn't just materialize in a bank's vaults, did they? Somehow his boss had handled that, and done it well, Popoff reminded himself. Perhaps Ernst Model had been an amateur, but this man was not. Something to keep in mind, the former spy told himself in large, red, mental letters. There followed a few seconds of silence. Then, "Yes, I will require another operation." "What exactly?" Popoff asked, and got the answer immediately.
"Ah."
A nod. He even used the correct word. Operation. How very strange. Dmitri wondered if he'd be well advised to check up on his employer, to find out more about him. After all, his own life was now in pawn to him. And the reverse was true as well, of course. But the other man's life was not an immediate concern to Popoff. How hard would it be? To one who owned a computer and a modem, it was no longer difficult at all, if one had the time. For now it was clear. He'd have but one night in his apartment before traveling overseas again. Well, it was an easy cure for jet lag. They looked like robots, Chavez saw, peering around a computer-generated corner. The hostages, too, but in this case the hostages were computer-generated children, all girls in red and white striped dresses or jumpers. Ding couldn't decide which. It was clearly a psychological effect programmed into the system by whoever had set up the parameters for the program, called SWAT 6.3.2. Some California-based outfit had first produced this for Delta Force under a DOD contract overseen by Rand Corporation. It was expensive to use, mainly because of the electronic suit he wore. It was the same weight as the usual black mission suit. Lead sheets sewn into the fabric had seen to that. And everything down to the gloves was filled with copper wires and sensors that told the computer, an old Cray YMP, exactly what his body was doing, and in turn projected a computer-generated image into the goggles he wore. Dr. Bello gave the commentary, playing the roles of bad guy leader and good guy advisor in this particular game. Ding turned his head and saw Eddie Price right behind him, and Hank Patterson and Steve Lincoln across the way at the other simulated corner. Robotic figures with numbers on them to let him know who was who. Chavez pumped his right arm up and down 3 times, calling for flashbangs, then peered around the corner 1 more time. At his chair, Clark saw the black line appear on the white corner, then hit the 7 key on his computer keyboard. Bad guy No. 4 trained his weapon on the gaggle of schoolgirls. "Steve, now," Chavez ordered. Lincoln pulled the pin on the flashbang. It was essentially a grenade simulator, heavy in explosive charge to produce noise and magnesium powder for a blinding flash,
simulated for the computer program, and designed to blind and disorient through the ear-shattering blast, which was loud enough to upset the inner ear's mechanism for balance. That sound, though not quite as bad, came through their earphones as well.